Hello, it is Wednesday, May 13th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. US and Chinese officials held last-minute talks in South Korea ahead of a Trump-Xi summit in Beijing. More on that in News Briefing. On Wednesday Election Watch, we head to the Jeolla region to look at the key local election and by-election races, the candidates, polling trends and issues shaping voter sentiment ahead of the June 3rd vote. And on Korea Book Club, we discuss Minbak by Ella Lee, a Korean diaspora family saga that explores three generations of women. Let's start Korea 24 right now. Key U.S. and Chinese officials met in South Korea on Wednesday ahead of the summit talks between President Donald Trump and Xi Jinping in Beijing. As he was getting ready to depart to Beijing, Trump told reporters he's planning to have a long talk with Xi about the war in Iran. Our KBS World Radio news reporter, Bae Ji-yeon, joins us now in the studio to give us the latest on this story as well as other headlines of the day. Hello, Ji-yeon.
Hello, Elena.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Chinese Vice Premier He Lefang began holding last-minute negotiations in South Korea after visiting President Lee Jae-myung in his office Wednesday. Before we go further into Lee's meeting with the two officials, can you first tell us about what Trump said to reporters about his upcoming trip?
Speaking to reporters on Tuesday ahead of his trip to Beijing, Trump said he'll have a long discussion with Xi about the war in Iran, while also claiming that he won't need Xi's help in dealing with Tehran. Let's listen to what he said.
Good things are going to happen. This is going to be a very exciting trip. A lot of good things are going to happen.
Do you think he needs to intervene at all with the Iranians?
I don't think he can help in any way? No, I don't think we need any help with Iran. We'll win it one way or the other. We'll win it peacefully or otherwise. Their navy's gone.
While the war is damaging his approval ratings at home, Trump has previously expressed frustration with Beijing for failing to use its economic leverage over Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz.
And do we know what Trump and Xi will talk about?
The Iran war is apparently high on the agenda, alongside other pending issues such as tariffs, supply chains, artificial intelligence, and Taiwan. Trump is set to arrive in Beijing on Wednesday night for a three-day state visit, 9 years after his previous visit during his first term in office.
Now let's get to the details on President Lee's back-to-back meetings with Ha and Bessent. Let's first tell us about how Lee's meeting went with Bessent.
Presidential spokesperson Kang Yoo-jung said that upon meeting with Bessent, Lee stressed the need for their countries to further strengthen bilateral cooperation on supply chains for critical minerals and the foreign exchange market. Bessent, for his part, agreed with Lee on the need for stronger bilateral cooperation. He also said that thanks to Lee's leadership, South Korea is demonstrating a remarkable performance in growth and stocks compared with other countries amid difficult conditions, including the war in Iran.
And what was discussed during the president's meeting with the Chinese vice premier?
Lee vowed Seoul's best efforts to help Ha's negotiations with Bessent proceed smoothly, stressing that the advancement of U.S.-China ties will promote the development and prosperity of countries around the world. Lee then stressed the need for Seoul and Beijing to continue close communication to reap substantial results in various areas, including economics, industry, trade, and culture. In response, Ha vowed best efforts for the smooth implementation of agreements reached between Lee and Xi, crediting the strategic leadership of both presidents for the fact that despite global uncertainties, bilateral trade posted higher growth in the first half of the year compared with last year.
Meanwhile, in Washington, South Korea's Defense Minister Ang Yu-baek met with U.S. Secretary of War Pete Hegseth. What are the highlights of their meeting?
� told reporters in Washington on Tuesday that in meeting Hegseth the previous day, he conveyed Seoul's willingness to consider ways to ensure freedom of navigation in the Strait of Hormuz. An said he told Hegseth that Seoul may consider joining the efforts in phases, possibly starting with a public statement endorsing the initiative and continuing with other actions, such as dispatching personnel, sharing intelligence, or providing military assets.
Now, An and Hegseth's meeting came in the wake of an attack on a South Korean cargo ship in the Strait of Hormuz. South Korea's Foreign Minister Cho Hyun says an attack by militia cannot be ruled out as the cause of an explosion and fire aboard the HMM Namu cargo ship in the strait last week. Tell us more about that.
While speaking to reporters in Seoul Wednesday, Cho was asked if the unidentified aerial objects that struck the 38,000-ton vessel on May 4th could be drones. He replied that it would be difficult to jump to a conclusion. Cho said there are many agents in Iran that could have orchestrated the attack, including militia. Experts earlier suggested that the aerial objects that struck the HMM Namu could be self-destructive drones that the Iranian military has frequently used in its war against the U.S.
Let's shift gears now to some economic news. The countdown has begun for a general strike by Samsung Electronics' largest labor union starting May 21st. This is because the electronics giant and the union failed to reach an agreement on performance-based bonuses after marathon discussions ended early Wednesday morning. I understand that now attention is being directed to the government.
Yes, attention is now being paid to whether the government will intervene by invoking emergency mediation authority to temporarily block the labor action amid concerns it could also impact South Korea's artificial intelligence-driven semiconductor supercycle and the economy. Labor Minister Kim Yong-hoon, speaking on a YouTube program the same day, drew a line saying the matter needs to be resolved through dialogue. Kim added that the government will do its best to arrange dialogue to prevent a strike. The government appears to be taking a cautious stance, as aggressive intervention could lead to head-on conflict with labor rights guaranteed by the Constitution, as well as strong opposition from the labor movement.
And June, could you remind our listeners exactly what demands the union is making?
The union early declared it would launch an 18-day strike unless its demands were met to set bonuses at 15% of operating profit, abolish the payout cap, and systemize the bonus system. Meanwhile, Samsung Electronics is waiting for the Suwon District Court to rule on an injunction it filed to ban the union's planned labor actions. The court is expected to issue its ruling by next Wednesday, a day before the start of the strike.
Staying on economic news, the Korea Development Institute has projected that the South Korean economy will expand 2.5% this year on the back of strong growth in the semiconductor industry. Now, that's higher than previously forecast, right?
Yes, that's correct. The state-run think tank's outlook issued on Wednesday is higher than the Institute's 1.9% forecast issued in February. The KDI noted that despite challenging business conditions, the economy has been showing signs of improvement this year due to strong semiconductor exports and improved domestic consumption. In particular, the KDI explained that the impact of strong semiconductors has been enough to make up for some of the fallout of the Middle East war. However, the Institute warned that if the conflict in the Middle East intensifies or drags on, there is a possibility that growth will weaken due to disruptions in raw material supply and demand and higher production costs.
And is the Institute's projection higher than that of the Bank of Korea?
Yes, the figure is higher than the 2% expansion projected by the Bank of Korea and the government, and much higher than the growth forecasts of 1.7% and 1.9% made by the OECD and IMF, respectively.
And that wraps up today's news briefing. Thanks so much, Gian, for bringing us the headlines.
Thanks, Alana.
The June 3rd local elections and National Assembly by-elections are now just 3 weeks away. Korea 24 is taking a closer look at the key battlegrounds across the country, the local issues, candidate lineups, and political dynamics that could shape the results. On today's Wednesday Election Watch, we turn to the Western Jeolla region, where voters will choose the first mayor of the newly integrated Jeonnam Gwangju Special City, as well as three lawmakers. We'll look at the major candidates, what recent opinion polls are showing, and the local issues that could decide the races. To help us break it all down, we're joined again today by Seoul-based journalist Andrew Jung. Great to have you with us, Mr. Jung.
Hello.
We're also joined by Choi Jung-hyun, Professor of Political Science at Jungbuk National University in Jeonju, North Jeolla Province, who will help us understand local voter sentiment and the issues shaping the race on the ground. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the candidates and the latest polling, let's first set the scene and look at why this region matters. Mr. Jung, could you introduce the Jeolla region to us? Which seats are up for grabs and why? What are the broad political tendencies in these areas?
The first thing I think we should note is that the southwestern Jeolla region has traditionally leaned left. When a conservative candidate wins, it becomes a major political story. It's happened before, but it's a rare occurrence. So usually the region is a battleground between left-leaning candidates within the country. And considering the atmosphere we're in, I think it would make front page news if any conservative candidate wins in the region. So the governor's office for North China province is up for grabs this time around. The mayorships of major cities, that would include Chunju, where Professor Che is, Bukpo, the local legislatures and local education offices will also elect new representatives. And one more thing to note is that this will be the first election of the century in which voters will pick an official to be both the South China governor and the mayor of the region's largest city, Gwangju. There's also major parliamentary districts that will have by-elections, two of them in the North China province area and then one in the city of Gwangju. Again, the most populous city in the region, home to 1.3 million people. So there's a lot going on, but again, this region is tends to lean left, so don't expect any conservatives to make any, victories in this time around especially, and that's what's going to happen this June.
Professor, as we just mentioned, you are based in North Jola province. Can you tell our listeners about the political characteristics of the two provinces in the Jola region?
Oh, sure. The Jola region is made up of two provinces, North Jola, now officially Jambuk Special Self-Governing Province, and South Jola province, which will merge with Gwangju on July 1st, as Andrew explained. Taken together, these areas are often called Honam, and it's been South Korea's most consistently progressive and Democratic Party-leaning region. That political pattern has deep historical roots. Many people in the region have long felt politically marginalized, especially under earlier conservative and authoritarian governments. And the memory of the May 18 Gwangju democratization movement and its brutal repression remains central to Honam's political identity. So for many voters in Jola, party choice is not just about policy issues. It is also tied to larger questions of democracy, regional equality, and historical justice. That said, Democratic Party dominance in Honam is not absolute. The best example would be the 2016 general election. An Cheol-soo's newly formed People's Party swept the region and pushed the Democratic Party out of what had long been considered its stronghold. That episode showed that Honam support is conditional, not automatic. So if voters feel taken for granted, or if they believe the party has drifted away from their concerns, they are willing to send a strong message, usually not by turning conservative, but by supporting another non-conservative alternative or independent candidates.
So just to briefly summarize, while historically a very left-leaning region, as with all politics, of course, nothing absolute. Let's now zoom in on the candidates. Mr. Jung, which elections in the Jola region are drawing the most attention? And tell us who are the key candidates.
Yes, I think the most interesting will be the governor race in North Jola. The Democratic Party has put forward Lee Won-taek, a lawmaker that served in the parliament until very recently. He will be facing off against Kim Kwan-young, a independent and also the incumbent. But we should note that he's also a former Democratic Party politician whose political leanings have swung between moderate conservative to moderate liberal. The Democratic Party has attacked his, diverse political leanings. The Democratic Party has also sought to capitalize on the fact that Kim Kwan-young is facing potential criminal charges. Kim Kwan-young apparently gave several hundred of dollars worth of cash to 20 or so party members at a party, as in Democratic Party, members at a dinner meeting to pay for their rides home. And police is investigating whether that cash had any strings attached, meaning whether Kim Kwan-young sought to buy their votes in any upcoming election. Again, the monetary amount involved in that particular case is relatively small. It's not, it's not even tens of thousands or thousands of dollars. It's a few hundred dollars, but still, I think there is a point there in the sense that he might have been attempting to buy their votes. That's a scandal. Splitting voters that will vote in the governor race in that particular province. Other elections that we should look at is the parliamentary seats for grabs in that same province, in the Kunzan, Kimje, and Puan area. It's a coastal area. Kim Igyum, a former Blue House spokesman during the Moon Jae-in administration and a former lawmaker, he will run to win that seat. The other seat in the same province is up for grabs, and a politician named Park Ji-won will be running for a seat, not to be confused with another older Park Ji-won. This time around, it'll be a young Park Ji-won who's in his late 30s. So again, not to be confused with the 80-something Park Ji-won. This Park Ji-won is much younger. And then we go to Gwangju and the South Cholla area, where the front runner is Min Hyung-bae, a lawmaker from the Democratic Party and the likely favorite to win. Other left-leaning candidates will include Justice Party's Kang Eun-mi. She's also a former lawmaker, and the Jinbo Party's Lee Jong-wook and independent Kim Kwang-man. From the Conservative Party, we have Lee Jung-hyun. He is one of the rare conservatives to ever won any seat in that part of the country. He hails from the region that probably serves an advantage to him. He will be running in Gwangju, but again, it's pretty doubtful he wins there. If he does, then that's going to be the story of the election, I guess. But that's what's up. And the interesting race, again, will be in the North Cholla province's governor's office.
Now, Professor Che, when it comes to these races, which one do you think will matter most in shaping the overall election narrative? And to frame all that, what would count as a good night for each party? So if the ruling party performs well across the region, but perhaps loses the North Cholla governor's race to a DP-turned independent candidate, could it still claim victory? Does the rebuilding Korea Party even have a realistic path to make inroads in Cholla? And for the People Power Party, what would be the minimum result needed to call this a breakthrough?
Well, two races in Cholla, I think, will matter most for the broader election narrative. The first is the North Cholla governor's race, which Andrew has already discussed in quite detail. Before his expulsion, Kim Kwan-young was widely reported to be leading in the polls. And even now, a poll released just 2 days ago showed him narrowly leading Lee, about 43% to 40%. That is within the margin of error, so it is not a clear lead. But symbolically, it is still very important. It means an expelled independent is still highly competitive against the Democratic Party's nominee in one of the party's safest regions.
Just some details before we move on. That survey that was mentioned was conducted by Joan C&I, commissioned by the local news outlet News One. The approval rating for independent Kim Kwan-young stood at 43.2%. Support for the Ruling Democratic Party's Lee Won-taek reached 39.7%. The poll conducted from Saturday to Sunday has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.1 percentage points, with a confidence rate of 95%.
Well, the second race to watch is the Gwangsan Il-bae election in Gwangju. Voters there will choose a new member of the National Assembly. It looks like it'll be a six-way race. And the key question is how well the Rebuilding Korea Party of Choguk performs. If it does well there, then that could strengthen its claim to be more than just a temporary protest party and could affect its national standing after the election. So turning to each party in turn, for the Democratic Party, the bar is very high because Honam is its political heartland. So a satisfactory result really means something close to a clean sweep. And the party leadership has more or less set that expectation itself. The biggest test of that standard would be North Cholla governor's race. Earlier this week, the party declared Kim permanently ineligible to return to the party, and Chairman Chung Chung-rae has also personally framed the race as a matter of party loyalty. And Kim's camp has been pushing back hard. They accused Chung of turning the Democratic Party into his personal political vehicle and argue that voter anger toward Chung is already showing up in the polls. So if the party loses Chambuk, it'll be a serious defeat for the current Democratic leadership. For the Rebuilding Korea Party, Choguk's party, this is its first regular local election since the party was created, and Honam is clearly at the center of its national strategy. The party is trying to build on its strong showing in the 2024 general election, when it actually outpolled the Democratic Party's satellite party in the proportional vote across Honam by about 7 percentage points. Its message is that it can be a sharper, more uncompromising progressive alternative to the Democratic Party. And it already has a foothold, actually. In the April 2025 Damyang by-election, it won its first county chief office in Honam. So I would say that if the party can defend Damyang, pick up a few more mayoral or county chief posts, and win council vote share somewhere in the high teens to mid-20s, then it could plausibly call that a breakthrough. Now, finally, for the Reform Party and the People Power Party, expectations are much more modest. In Honam, even small gains can carry symbolic weight because both parties have performed so poorly there in the past. So if the Reform Party can cross the 10% mark and the People Power Party can cross the 15% mark in local races, that would already look like a meaningful breakthrough. But even that may be quite difficult, given that Honam is the Democratic Party's political heartland, and the current sitting Democratic president remains very popular.
So we've covered what success could look like for the different parties and how differently it could range. Let's now talk about the different issues that could actually move voters. Mr. Jung, what are the key election issues in the region? And tell us about the key pledges of the candidates.
So again, going to North Cholla, one of the big issues is going to be the scandal that we just discussed about the incumbent governor, Kim Gwan-young, whether or not that leads to any charges, whether that reveals or any allegations that have been thrown his way. Kim Gwan-young has tried to describe those allegations as politically motivated. So I guess his supporters are more on the side that those allegations are politicized and thus have real no substance. While on the other hand, the other side, Iwon-taek is pushing the narrative that Kim Gwan-young is corrupt and had tried to buy votes and that he should be kicked out, not only because of the fact that he's been charged with those allegations, but the fact that he's moved in between parties and the Democratic Party has tried to, I guess, portray that as a ideological snag on the governor. In terms of pledges, Iwon-taek has pledged that he would increase transparency in government decisions. He said he would try to break away from reliance on central government cash by focusing on homegrown industries. He has also talked about increasing cash subsidies to farmers and fishers, investment in renewable energy. A lot of those pledges overlap with Kim Gwan-young's, but Kim Gwan-young has, if you look at his pledges, it's a little more, I guess, industry focused. He has pledged to develop AI, humanoid, and hydrogen-linked industries. He has put out the number of 50 trillion won in investment that he would try to attract if he's reelected. He's also pledged bringing in 15 more Chaebol-affiliated corporate offices to the region. So if you look at those pledges, you can kind of get a grasp of where their as economic views are leaning. Moving on to a different election in the same region, the parliamentary election, the younger Bak Ji-won, who's running for a seat there, he has pledged investment in more infrastructure, port facilities, airport, railroad access. He has talked about bringing more investment from Hyundai Motors, which has a significant presence in the region. Bak Ji-won has also talked about fostering growth in new industries. Smart farms is something that he's talked about. Agriculture, again, is something big in that part of town. Moving on to the Gwangju South Cholla race, the candidates there have also talked about similar themes. The front runner, Min Young-bae, has talked about increasing transparency in government decisions by live broadcasting the meetings at the governor slash mayor's office. The conservative candidate, Lee Jung-yeon, he has talked about trying to attract 10 Chaebol-affiliated corporations to the region. to serve what he calls, quote, anchor companies, employers that are leaders in their industries or have an outsized influence on the region's economy. So a lot of these pledges sound a little old. They've been talked about before. I don't know what the voters, individual voters, will think or make of them, but some of them also sound very interesting. The smart farm sounded fun. The Chebla corporations moving into that region would certainly be helpful. But again, those are pledges that people have heard of and not seen a lot of fruit in previous elections. But yeah, these are kind of what's being talked about. So some old and some new.
Well, Professor Che, let me ask you about individual voters, because from your perspective as someone who lives in this region and works in this region, what do you think voters on the ground most want to hear from the candidates?
Well, I think the single most important demand is this. Voters in Honam do not want to be taken for granted. Many voters feel that in national elections, the Democratic Party spends much of its energy trying to appeal to Yeongnam, the Gyeongsang provinces, while treating Honam as a safe and automatic source of support. So what voters want is not just symbolic recognition. They want candidates who can address very concrete problems in the region, such as rapid population decline, a weakening industrial base, and the need to bring new industries into the region. In Gwangju and Jeonnam, there is also the added question of how the new Jeonnam-Gwangju integrated special city will be governed and how to make sure one side does not dominate the other. And at a deeper level, many voters still feel that Honam has been left behind in South Korea's economic development. So they want serious and realistic proposals for attracting next generation industries, including AI, biotech, and advanced manufacturing. For Jeonbuk or North Jeolla, where I am in, the key issues are especially clear. It's long-running push to get the city of Jeonju designated as South Korea's third financial hub, alongside Seoul and Busan, and the future of the Saemangeum development project.
Let's now talk about the current state of the race and, of course, what the numbers are telling us. Mr. Jeong, give us the latest results from the polls.
Right. So we have limited figures in the sense that some candidates for certain districts haven't been finalized. But since the North Jeolla province serves to be the most interesting, the most competitive, and the most, I guess, media attention grabbing, if we could focus on that particular region, there was a recent poll, I think, that Professor Che mentioned earlier today, conducted by pollster Jowon CNI. That particular poll surveyed 1,000 adults in the province from May 9th to May 10th, so pretty recent. It had a confidence level of 95%, plus or minus 3.1%. And that poll showed that 43.2% of respondents supported Kim Kwan-young, the incumbent, who's in the lead. So that's very interesting. While 39.7% of respondents said they supported Lee Won-taek. Now, that difference is, again, within roughly within the margin of error, a little outside it, but close enough to say that it's, you know, they're neck and neck. So it would be very interesting to see who's going to win there. And there's been no, I guess, poll regarding the Gwangju South Jeolla candidates. But if, again, I think something that Professor Chan mentioned earlier, if the conservative candidate can pull 10% or higher, even if he loses, that would be a spectacular performance, especially regarding the political atmosphere in the sense that the People Power Party is not very popular at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, beyond the polls, of course, there's the question of strategy. Professor Che, what do the ruling and opposition parties need to do from here, just 3 weeks out, to win in this region?
Well, I think the first point is that winning means very different things for the ruling party and the opposition parties. For the ruling Democratic Party, winning in Honam really means, again, something close to a clean sweep because this is its historical stronghold. But the party cannot take that support for granted. It needs to offer concrete, future-oriented policies on industrial transition, on how to manage the integration of Jeonnam and Gwangju, and on the future of Saemangeum in North Jeolla. It also has to find a way to win the North Jala governor's race without further alienating voters who already have negative feelings about the current party leadership. I think that may be the party's most delicate task in the region. For the Rebuilding Korea Party, the path is narrower, but it is also more clearly defined. The party has to convert its proportional vote strength from the 2024 general election into real local seats. In practical terms, that means focusing resources on its strongest two or three areas, defending Damyang and trying to break through in one or two more counties. But seats alone will not be enough. The party also has to prove that it can govern locally and not just serve as a vehicle for protest votes against the Democratic Party. Finally, for the People Power Party and the Reform Party, the objective is much more modest. They need to maintain visibility and credibility. So if they can double their usual vote share in a few carefully chosen races and persuade voters that they are serious about staying in the region beyond this election, that would already count as a meaningful step forward.
And that's all we have time for on today's Wednesday Election Watch, but we'll continue tracking the major races across the country as Election Day approaches. A big thank you to journalist Andrew Jung for walking us through the key battlegrounds. Thank you, Mr. Jung.
Thank you.
And thank you as well to Professor Choi Jung-hyun of Jeonbuk National University. Thank you so much for your insights, Professor.
Well, thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 200.86 points or 2.63% on Wednesday to close at 7,844.01. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ slid 2.36 points or 0.2% to close at 1,176.93. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Alana.
Okay, Daniel, what's our starting point today?
A man who allegedly led a multi-million dollar hacking scheme targeting Koreans, including BTS vocalist Jungkook, has been extradited to South Korea.
Well, why don't you start by walking us through the scale of this scheme and how it was carried out?
So a Chinese national male in his 40s allegedly siphoned 38 billion won, or 25.4 million US dollars, away from victims' accounts between August 2023 and April 2025 as part of a crime ring that stole money by poaching personal information from public services websites.
It sounds like this crime ring had major ambitions, even targeting, like you said, a global star like Jungkook. Were they actually able to carry out any part of that plan?
Well, in January 2024, the crime ring allegedly used Jungkook's name to open brokerage accounts in an effort to take 8.4 billion won worth of BTS members' shares in the entertainment company HYBE, which is a subsidiary of Big Hit Music. Thankfully, Jungkook was protected from this attempt. However, the group managed to steal from several high-profile corporate and entertainment figures.
And what's the latest development in the related investigation?
Well, the Justice Ministry announced Wednesday that the Chinese male, who allegedly led the hacking scheme, has been extradited to South Korea, landed in Incheon the previous day after a flight from Bangkok, and was turned over to police, who are in the process of seeking a warrant for his arrest.
Daniel, let's move on to our next story now.
Son Heung-min of the Los Angeles Football Club and captain of the South Korean national team is officially the second highest paid footballer this year in the Major League Soccer, also known as MLS. He is guaranteed a salary of over 11 million US dollars. But that's not all. On top of the guaranteed amount the MLS will pay him, he will still be earning more from sponsorships and partnerships with brands or clubs.
Well, being the second highest earner in US pro soccer, it's definitely impressive. Naturally, we have to ask, who's in the top spot?
None other than the man who led his country's national team to the top in last World Cup, Argentine football icon Lionel Messi. he will be earning over double what Son is set to earn at a guaranteed more than $20 million. Trailing Son is Rodrigo De Paul, who plays for Inter Miami at over $9 million.
And I imagine the league has every reason to want all three of these players to stay.
Yes, MLS star power is at an all-time high, driven mainly by elite global superstars from top leagues around the globe, like Son and Messi. And they would want to not just maintain this status, but build on it. The MLS paid about $26.5 million in a transfer fee when Son left the Premier League to join the LA Football Club. Along with Messi, whose contract ends in 2028, both players will be handsomely paid for their net worth.
Okay, let's turn now to our final story of the day.
The 79th Cannes Film Festival officially kicked off, and at the opening ceremony, director Park Chan-wook spoke about his role as the chair of the festival competition jury, while also highlighting Korea's elevated status and role in the global film industry.
Okay, tell us, what did he say about how he plans to approach his role as jury chair?
In the press conference held on Tuesday local time, he outlined his dual approach to viewing and evaluating the entries as the jury president, emphasizing he will evaluate films with pure eyes of an audience. Have a listen to Park's comments at the press conference held with an interpreter on site.
예, 저는 순수한 관객의 눈으로 영화를 볼 작정을 하고 왔습니다.
I'm prepared to watch films with the pure eyes of an audience, without any prejudice or stereotype, just excitement to watch films that would surprise me. But after I finish watching the films and we're doing the discussions, I will have to talk in the eyes of an expert who has clear insights and knowledge of film history.
역사를 알고 있는 전문가로서 평가를 하려고 합니다.
What did the legendary director credit for his appointment as jury chair?
Well, the first Korean director to chair the main competition jury at the Cannes Film Festival stated that the main reason he was given the honor is because of Korea's status in the global cinema industry. Have a listen.
한국은 더 이상 변방 영화의 변방 국가가 아니게 되었죠.
Korea is no longer at the outskirts of the global cinematic industry. And when I describe this phenomena, I think the reason behind it isn't only because Korean film did very well and made it to the center of the industry. I think it's because the center of the global film industry itself has expanded, and now it is ready to embrace films of different countries. And as a result of that, I could become the president of the jury here at Cannes. And because of that, there have been three Korean films that I have high expectations for selected at the film festival this year. All of this to say, I am not going to be biased towards Korean works. I will judge very fairly and equally.
한국 영화에 더 점수를 주거나 하지는 않을 겁니다.
He also reflected on his maiden visit to Cannes in 2004 for Old Boy. Park said back then Korean films were rarely introduced, and he marveled at how, in just around two decades, so much has changed.
Did any other questions about modern cinema stand out during this press conference?
Yes, he was asked if he believed cinema and politics should be separated. Park firmly replied no, that art should not be seen as the enemy of politics just because it contains political statements. Art and politics are not opposing concepts. If political messages are artistically well expressed, they deserve to be heard. And this year, director Na Hong-jin's new film Hope advanced to the competition section, while director Yeon Sang-ho's Colony entered midnight screening. Director Julai Jung Stora was invited to director's fortnight, so there's a very healthy dose of Korean cinema in the Cannes Film Festival.
Well, that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thanks so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's time now for Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature and books, exploring works either in Korean or English translations. And joining us this week, we welcome back our book critic, Fei Leung. Fei, hello, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, Fei, let's dive right in. What book have you got for us this week?
All right, I've got a bit of a special book this week. It's special because this book isn't translated from Korean, but was originally written in English. It's called Minbak, and it was written by Ella Lee. She's half Korean and half Turkish, and she grew up in London, where she wrote this book.
Sounds so interesting. And of course, it's always wonderful to hear voices from the Korean diaspora. Faye, what is this book about?
So Minbak is a family saga with two interconnected plot lines. The story jumps between London in 2008 and Korea in the 1980s. It's told from the perspectives of three generations of women. Yongja, the grandmother, Hana, the mother, and Ada, the daughter. If you ask me, the plot of this book is a veritable roller coaster, and I think it would make a smashing K-drama someday. Let me tell you why. The story opens in London in 2008, and it starts with Hana's husband dying all of a sudden in a car accident. This turns the whole world upside down for Hana, not only because she and her daughter now have to deal with this humongous grief, but also because it turns out Hana's husband was keeping secrets before he passed.
Okay, well, we've only just begun. Faye, I'm already hooked. I mean, there's nothing like a good family saga to pique personally my interest, especially when it comes with the promise of skeletons in the closet. Mm-hmm. And as you said, I mean, if that's not going to make a great K-drama, at least a K-movie someday. Now, I'm dying to know, though, what was Hannah's husband keeping from her before he died?
Right. Remember that this is 2008. Smack bang in the middle of the financial crisis. Hiding in the house, Hana finds unpaid bills, maxed out credit cards, letters of warning from debtors. And it turns out her husband had left them up to their ears in debt. And then all of a sudden, people show up at Hana's doorstep, stomping into her house and seizing things left and right. Just like that, her peaceful, comfortable world implodes all around her.
So Hana just doesn't lose her husband. She also, you know, it sounds like she loses the financial stability her whole life was built on.
Yeah, that's right. And she has no choice but to sell everything that she can. Jewelry, valuables, and everything that's worth any money. She's pawning them all. And she just barely manages to hold on to her house. But that is it. A roof over her family's head. Mm. Before all of this happened, Hana's mother, Yongja, had been living in a nursing home because she has Alzheimer's. But now, Hana simply can't afford that anymore, so she's forced to bring her home to live together with them. But now, Hana is faced with an even bigger problem. You see, she'd been a housewife for years, relying on her husband as her sole source of financial support, and she has no employable skills to speak of, let alone something to make a living with. Desperate, Hana turns to the only resource that she has left, her house. She decides that the only way forward is to turn her house into a minbak. Now, a minbak is essentially a bed and breakfast where you rent rooms to guests and you serve them food. She decides right there to turn all four bedrooms into rooms for rent. What about the family, you ask? Well, as for Hana, Ada, and Yongja, the three women have no choice but to squeeze themselves into what used to be their living room. To save costs, they give on bunk beds and sleep on the floor, traditional Korean style. As you can imagine, stuffing three generations into one single room causes no small amount of friction. In that tiny, tiny living room, crammed in with their belongings, old wounds that never quite healed begin to reopen, and secrets that were swept under the rug for years and years start to resurface.
Well, I love a good story of old, dusty family secrets coming to light. Now, I'm guessing that these secrets are somehow connected to that second plot line you've mentioned, the one that's set in Korea in the 1980s.
And you would be right on the mark. You see, history has repeated itself because 30 years ago, it was Yongja, the grandmother, who was struggling to make ends meet. And it was Yongja who turned their Korean home into a minbak herself. That was the minbak that Hana grew up in. For Hana, though, that home wasn't just a place of warm childhood memories. It was also the place where her world shattered into a million pieces and she was changed forever. That life-changing event was what made Hana move all the way to London, so far away from her homeland and her family, because that's how desperately she needed to forget and to start over. And the thing is, Yongja, her mother, had a direct hand in this catastrophe. But for fear of spoiling the plot, this is as far as I will go to describe the events of this book. What I can promise you is this. The rest of the story is full of twists and scandalous revelations.
Okay, I'm literally on the edge of my seat. I'm dying to pick your brains and ask you everything. But of course, you know, cannot spoil the plot. No spoilers here. Exactly. Let's talk, though, a little bit more about the historical context of this book. It was newly published this year. Why do you think the author chose to write about the specific time periods that she did?
Well, I think that Ella Lee chose this specific period of time because she wanted to bring certain aspects of recent Korean history to the international reader's attention. These days, as you all know, interest in Korea and Korean culture is on the rise globally, but the typical foreign reader, me included, would have quite a few gaps in their knowledge of Korean history. And at the center of this book is a key historical issue that hugely impacted both Korea and the Korean diaspora, the Korean adoption scandal. This refers to the controversial program in the 1970s to 80s that fraudulently sent hundreds of thousands of babies overseas and put them up for adoption. Why? Because an interconnected web of vested interests was making money off of every single baby sent overseas. And to achieve these nefarious goals, children whose parents were still alive were falsely labeled as orphans, and families were torn apart. The consequences of these events still reverberate today. Ella Lee writes explicitly in her afterword that she hopes her novel will direct readers to learn more about this crucial but painful part of Korean history.
It's such an impressive goal by Ella Lee. I think that makes this story even more relevant. Now, Faye, if I'm correct, this is actually her only second novel, yet it's been really well received internationally, and it's featured in the best-selling section of many bookstores. What do you think her secret is? What is it about Ella Lee's writing that, you know, so many readers are finding just so compelling?
You know, I think it's a combination of multiple factors. First of all, there is the multi-layered plot that takes you on a wild ride. There are two timelines, multiple perspectives, and subplots on the side. So, all in all, in this book, you have a lot to keep you glued to the pages. It's also blatantly clear that Ella Lee did a lot of very rigorous historical research when she wrote this book. She sets the fictional timeline against real, major historical events, and this adds a lot of weight to the story. More than anything, though, what impressed me personally the most was Ella Lee's writing.
Well, let's talk a bit more about that. So ultimately, it's not just about the story itself, but the way that Ella Lee tells it that really you find makes the book stand out.
Yes, exactly. She is an extremely synesthetic writer, and she employs words in a unique, refreshing way. Her writing style adds a vivid, cinematic quality to her novel. Let me give you a few examples, and you'll see what I mean. Here is Ella Lee describing what life with Alzheimer's is like for Yongja. Yongja sat in the sun-drenched conservatory at the farm, facing the lawns, bathing in summer light. It was brutal bliss to exist in this way, void of content, the present coming, going, for her only shedding, never actualizing into the past. Do you see what I mean about Lee's writing being cinematic?
It's honestly very vivid.
Yeah, you can almost feel yourself in the scene.
Yeah.
Now, let me read you one more passage. This is from Ada's point of view this time, and it's about when she stumbled upon her mother, Hannah, crying over an old notebook. The pages may have aged, but those tears were freshly frothed and overflowing. There was something kinetic here, snaking a path, knocking dominoes as it moved. Now, descriptions like this one fill up the entire book. Ella Lee makes reading feel like a full-body experience. And for me, this is what sets her book apart.
Well, Faye, if this hasn't convinced our listeners to head to the bookstores, I don't know what will. Thank you so much for bringing this gem to the table today and for sharing those really beautiful excerpts.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back with more of the stories shaping life here in Korea and beyond. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thank you so much for joining us. And until tomorrow, take care and goodbye.
KBS World Radio.